What is up, wrestling fans, and welcome to episode 2 of the Paul Heyman SmackDown podcast, where we go back in time to the year 2002 and review SmackDown under Paul Heyman's creative leadership. And who are we? Well, I am your host, Callum Wiggins, and joining me on this journey back in time, as per usual, is Robert DeFelice.
Yes, Callum, man. You know, I think in these trying times, the fact that an American and an Englishman can come together on the 4th of July and celebrate something should be a sign for us all.
How do you typically celebrate the 4th of July, Rob?
Barbecues, fireworks, lots of just red, white, and blue. You know, a lot of the commercialized patriotism that is associated with America in general. How about you? Like, what's the 4th of July for you? Is it ever, like, weird over there?
I tend to just put a crown on and pretend that we still own America. That's kind of how my celebration goes. I just put on the crown, put on the robe, and pretend that you guys didn't break free all those hundreds of years ago. So this is the second episode of our Paul Heyman podcast. I hope you enjoyed episode 0 and episode 1. This is the first time that we're recording it at a point where Paul Heyman is no longer the head writer for Monday Night Raw. So you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, we are recording this in advance, but so who knows what else is going to come out. But as we will learn throughout this podcast, Vince and Heyman don't always mesh in creative structures together. And as much as Paul Heyman likes to say, Vince would rather have him in the castle pissing out than out of the castle pissing in, it seems like he's been removed from the castle once again to try and piss in the castle.
Yeah, so that's probably just a bit of housekeeping to get up there. Now we're up to speed with the fact that Heyman's no longer control, but we're still going to keep doing this because we're already a couple of episodes in and it seems a bit weird to just cut it short at that point and just say, okay, Heyman's gone, going to finish it off. Because the real reason we're watching this is because we just love this era of WWE, so we're going to try and enjoy it as much as we possibly can. I would also like to say, just for anyone else that's been listening, I do encourage you to check out the actual episodes that we're reviewing, either in advance or after we've reviewed them, whichever way. We're going to leave a link now in the description to the episode in question, so you can check it out at your leisure. Just so you know what we're talking about, if you thought anything particularly interesting, what we said, you want to check out for yourself, or you want to listen to in advance, and so you have your own opinions that you can put in the comment section below if you're watching on YouTube, then, yeah, I just want to get everyone involved and engaged in the entire process. But without further ado, let's...
These are great episodes of SmackDown, so you should want to watch them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But without further ado, let's start off with a few news stories, big headlines from this week. I guess the big storyline from the WWE side of things was they reached a $3.5 million settlement with the Parents Television Council, so essentially the day prior to this episode of SmackDown that we're going to be reviewing, which was based around the idea that the Parents Television Council had been accusing WWE of glamorizing violence to children, and that had directly caused a number of children's deaths and injuries due to play fighting.
Yeah, WWE always gets flack for this, to the point where now they slap you in the face with how scripted and predetermined and not real it is. But you know, it is a violent television show. At the end of the day, parents should, you know, take a little bit more responsibility in what their kids were watching. I was a kid at this time, and I tell my mom all the time, I don't know how you let me get away with watching this. This is nothing but sex and violence.
It is quite interesting also that this settlement was worth more to WWE than how much they paid to buy WCW. That's just how badly WCW fell down to without television.
It's more of a response of how badly AOL Time Warner wanted WCW out of the portfolio.
Other news, there was a major, quite appropriate considering the current situation with Paul Heyman, there was a major backstage argument between Paul Heyman and Pat Patterson on one side and Triple H on the other, based around John Cena.
Really?
So we're going to talk about this episode of SmackDown. There's a segment that I'll probably bring up in more detail, but there was a segment where Cena is in backstage with Vince and Chris Jericho. And Heyman and Pat Patterson were pushing hard for the idea that to continue the momentum from Cena's match with Angle, that they should have him slap Vince McMahon. That obviously doesn't happen, and we'll explain what happens when we get to the actual review. But the reason why Triple H was against it, or there's many reasons why Triple H is against anything that could get another superstar over, especially at this time in his career. But that the idea was that they were building towards a potential Vince McMahon Hulk Hogan match at SummerSlam. And
right, and if the rookie slaps Vince and just gets away with it, it sends out a weird signal.
Yeah, Triple H was basically saying that nobody should touch Vince until he has that match with Hogan at SummerSlam, which they don't have that match at SummerSlam, so good job there.
You know what, though? That it's interesting. That SummerSlam was to be held in New York. I wonder if one of the reasons they wanted that match at SummerSlam is to get that like New York rub of it's the Vince and Hogan story in New York.
Probably. I think they always intended to do that match at some point. But as we'll find out, you don't get it at SummerSlam. If you wait until basically the very, very end of the journey, we will be talking about that match when it does happen.
Oh, yeah.
We'll also talk about this is when the week where Diamond Dallas Page officially retired after he got advised by WWE's medical team and his insurance company that due to the extent of his back injury, that it wasn't right for him to continue wrestling on a full-time schedule.
His last match was against Holly, right?
I believe so, yeah. Just, a guy that was dropped to SmackDown, and if he hadn't gone injured so early, maybe he still would have had a part to play in this journey. But now at this point, even at this point in 2002, he's no longer an active wrestler.
So we've pretty much covered the bulk of his WWE run between our 2001 podcast, which you can listen to in the archives, and I guess now, and it's just so disappointing.
So that's kind of like the main headlines going on. If we talk about what Raw was up to, because this is a competition still between Raw and SmackDown. Actually, I think this would be the appropriate time to bring up the ratings. So this is the lowest rated episode of SmackDown that we're going to be watching in the entire journey. This episode, in terms of ratings, was a 2.27, which compared to last week's one was 3.79. So that's a 1.5 drop. So it is a holiday show. It's 4th of July. These shows typically
No way people were crowded around the TV watching SmackDown.
Yeah, so the lowest rated episodes that we're going to see are built around. So it's this, and it's also the Thanksgiving episode as well. SmackDown got kind of screwed over by having their episodes on a number of holidays this year. They have an episode on 4th of July. They have an episode on Thanksgiving. They have an episode on Halloween. It's all pretty problematic for them on that front. So they got absolutely crushed by Raw's rating of a 3.6 for the July the 1st episode of Raw. So the match that happened, the main event was the Undertaker versus Jeff Hardy match.
I love that match. One of the best
ladder match for the championship. So we'll see Undertaker a very different style of title match on the main event of this episode of SmackDown.
Workhorse period?
I'd say his workhorse period is later. Because right now he's still fluctuating between being injured quite every now and again. But he's still working quite a fair amount. I mean, being Undisputed Champion, you have to work both shows. So he's working more than he will do probably for the rest of the journey that we're going to go on.
Yeah, his journey after the first pay-per-view we cover, his journey takes a bit of a nosedive for a bit.
So this is when Chris Benoit becomes part of the Raw brand. He makes his return. He sides with Eddie Guerrero. And I think Beats Up the Dudley Boys was their first real official feud coming back.
Well, they beat up RVD first in the ladder match. And then they do get into it with the Boys, I believe, because they fight the Dudleys
at Vengeance.
Yeah.
Yeah, in a tag team tables match. We'll have a review of that on the for our Patreon exclusive one, doing the Darkcast, which you can get at the $10 tier on our Patreon. And yeah, we'll be reviewing Vengeance 2002. So if you're signed up for that tier, then you'll be able to hear that review yourself. Another match that happened on Raw, Brock Lesnar defeated Ric Flair in one of those matches that you never really, I don't say it's like a dream match scenario, but it's one of the matches like, did that ever happen? And it did. It happened on a random episode of Raw.
Because back then, Raw was still, we're coming off the Attitude Era, and Raw is still important enough to where these matches are just happening out of the blue.
And there was some infighting in the NWO, and this was the first time that Michael referenced the fact that he wants Triple H to join the NWO.
Yeah, great angle, zero payoff, but...
Sounds like yeah. WWE to me.
Yeah, especially nowadays. But yeah, I love this angle, and wish we could have seen the true fruition.
But that's kind of all the admin side of things out of the way, so let's actually get forward into the review itself. So this is SmackDown 4th July 2002, recorded on the 2nd of July 2002, from the Fleet Center in Boston, Massachusetts. So yes. Home to a very, well, not close, the close enough, the official, like, Boston hometown of John Cena. Not exactly West Newbury, but this is where they would proclaim him to be from for the rest of his career.
Right, because, you know, we're not going to run a small city in Massachusetts, we're only going to run Boston.
So the show kicks off with a video package hyping Edge's return and getting his revenge on Chris Jericho. There's tons and tons of American flags and signs in the crowd, so you know what day it is.
Yeah, and let's be clear, this is the first Independence Day following 9/11.
Yeah, so everyone's super patriotic. Hogan's in title match, so everyone's super excited. So, so that's the announcement. The announcement is that Hogan and... Edge will be fighting Billy and Chuck for the World Tag Team Championships, and Undertaker will be fighting, defending his WWE Undisputed Championship. Again, I always get confused between Undisputed and United States. It's always been just an issue with me with these ones, but it'll be Undertaker versus Kurt Angle in the main event.
The American Badass against the American Hero on America's Birthday. I like that booking a lot.
And speaking of America's birthday, Lillian Garcia is out there about to perform a rendition of America the Beautiful, which she performs excellently. She does. She is an excellent singer. This was like her big song that she would do. Like, she did it for the 9/11 show. She does it here. And this is probably the song, at least from the WWE side of things, I think she performs the best. She gets really like a lot of emotion out of it.
Yeah, and they would use her. I think they used her for more than one WrestleMania.
But she doesn't get to finish the entire song because we've got to get heat on a American-based edition of SmackDown with the Un-Americans coming out. So at this point, they're not officially titled the Un-Americans, but it's the trio of Lance Storm, Christian, and Test. And the heat that they get from interrupting is immense. Like this is a point of time where it feels... very comparable to the heat that the Hart Foundation would get when they were in America.
Yeah, that's what they were going for. And I think that's really what they were hoping to establish. And we'll see in a later edition of this podcast how they even tried to get into it with Shawn Michaels. But behind the scenes, I know Christian in particular was not a fan of this angle. He did not like... doing an anti-American thing. He's like, you know, I live in America now. I have nothing against America. He had a hard time with the character.
It is very old-fashioned way of thinking. And to be fair, the Hart Foundation thing worked really well in 97. And this is only a few, like 5 years after it. So it's not like it's a million miles removed. But it still feels, especially going back in 2020 and looking at this, you kind of feel like, didn't they have any other ideas than just going, okay, there's three Canadians, so they must hate America, and so boo America, that type of rallying cry.
I will say, when you hear the promo they cut about how, you know, other countries think America is, you know, this entitled country, and hey, I thought the heat that they tried to get was good heat. Like, hey, how about Vietnam? Oh, that's a sore spot for you, because you lost. Like, they tried their best.
Hey, it resonated with me. They're the old baby faces in my mind.
There you go. I mean, they really do try their best, but it just feels out of place. And especially now, it feels real out of place.
Yeah, so Christian comes out and says things like that most people think Independence Day, they think the Will Smith movie.
I thought that was hysterical.
Yeah, that's a good line. There's some good lines in this. They're a bit crass, but like it does make sense. Like Lance Storm talks about how America is ungrateful to the British by declaring itself independent. Talks about how America pushes people around, mentions all the wars they're involved with, including the Vietnam, as Rob mentioned. Those loud, you suck chants. They talk about the fact that they don't want people like Lance Storm, Test, and Christian to speak, and that goes against their like freedom of expression, which is it's a very touchy subject that we could probably go on to like hours in discussing things like the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah, like the current climate of America. It's fun watching a show like this. That's the 4th of July on the first 4th of July after 9/11, as opposed to the current climate in the country. It's stark contrast. And this is not the only time I say stark contrast, because, you know, we got the Divas coming up.
But first we have Rikishi coming out to face Lance Storm in the match. So Rikishi dominates for the first few minutes. He's outpowering Storm. It's pretty similar to Storm's match with Mark Henry. It's just, it's a big guy against Lance Storm, and Storm is being ragdolled around by Storm goes for a sunset flip. Rikishi sits down. He takes out all the other un-Americans who tried to get interfered. Rikishi drags Storm into the corner, tries to go with the banzai drop, but Christian distracts him. Test hits a big boot from the apron, which I thought was pretty impressive. So he's actually standing on the apron and hits a big boot on Rikishi, who's in the ring.
I like Test. He's super underrated to me, and I wish he would have gotten a chance to shine a little bit more.
Yeah, so this big boot takes Rikishi out. Storm gets the pinfall. He gets the win. So it was a short match that followed like the lengthy promo, but it was quite effective.
I think it's interesting looking at these three characters, because Lance Storm in this angle looks the most sure of himself. Christian looks the most lost, and I think this was the last really good angle that Test would be a part of.
Yeah, I would look at those three, and I'd think in the WWE scale of things in 2002, or even like just in a Vince McMahon, Uber-controlled environment, that Test would be the one that you would position out of these three to go forward and be a main eventer. But looking at the three of them, I think, yeah, in this era, you could probably make Storm the main eventer out of these three.
Yeah.
So Undertaker arrives wearing head to toe black leather. I don't like this Undertaker.
must have been a hot day for Taker, because head to toe black leather in that heat. Ugh.
It's not exactly great preparations to take on an Olympic gold medalist, really, is it?
No, it's not, and I'm sure he must have been winded by the time that match was done.
So we have a video recap of John Cena's match with Kurt Angle, and then we see Stacy Keibler's ass. Backstage.
Well, we sure do.
We slowly get the revelation that that ass is attached to someone else's body, or attaches to her body, because we can see her. So it pans up. She approaches the men's locker room. Mark Henry answers. Stacy asks if John Cena's there. So Mark Henry is now relegated from his match last week to just being like the doorman. Cena arrives. Stacy says Vince is looking for him. So he goes off, and Stacy just checks him out, because that was Stacy's gimmick at the time, is that she was dating Vince McMahon, but she was obsessed with every other wrestler.
It's interesting that in this segment, even though it started with the ass shot, it was actually like Stacy checking out a guy instead of like Mark Henry opens the door and ogles her for 5 seconds. And I thought that was a refreshing change of pace. And the other thing I noted that was funny here was John Cena not knowing how to get in touch with Vince McMahon, like, oh, where's Vince's office? That's just funny knowing what we know now.
So we move on to a tag team match. We don't get enough of those on these episodes of SmackDown, already quite early on. But Randy Orton is going to be teamed with the Big Valboski against Reverend Devon and Batista. So last week, Orton teamed with Farouk to take on the pair of Devon and Batista. And so he's traded in one veteran for another.
I still hate the Big Valboski name.
Yeah, shouldn't work like that. Batista wrestles with earrings at this point in his career. I don't know if he did that much going forward, but it doesn't seem like a smart idea to wrestle with jewelry that could get... Well, to be fair, we found out at his cost in his final ever match that he shouldn't be wrestling with jewelry, because you can see
guys can do it. Yeah, I mean, they're going to rip it out of your nose.
Yeah. So Batista actually starts this match, because it was odd because essentially the entire last match was built around the fact that Devon wrestled 95% of it and Batista came in for a couple of moves and pinned the guy at the end of it. But he actually starts with Valboski and hits a massive clothesline. Batista at this point is very limited in the ring. But yeah, he's doing the big spots that get people over when you're his size. And so Devon tags in, he does the actual body of the wrestling. Orton does a lot of stuff with him afterwards. it gets quite messy towards the end. This isn't as like well put together as some of the other tag team matches we've seen. Batista blind tags in, hits another steamroller of a clothesline, another clothesline to Valboski, ducks Orton's crossbody, spine busters Orton, gets the pin. So Batista is 2-0 over Orton right now.
Do you think Triple H is just watching this like, yeah, I want them, and we need to switch them over to Raw because they don't end the year on SmackDown?
I kind of feel like Triple H is actually watching this and thinking, yeah, these guys are pretty good. But maybe in the back of his mind is thinking, so how do I make sure they're don't get ahead of me in the pecking order? That type of
right.
mindset. Oh yeah, I'll have them part of my faction, but it's my faction and they're like my lackeys. That's how I keep them at least an arm's length away from the main event picture.
Yeah, you set that pecking order. That's like, well, they're good and they might beat him once, but they'll never be better than him because they were his lackey.
Yeah, they could be the main eventers once I'm done being the main eventer. So we have the backstage segment that we referenced earlier with Chris Jericho is complaining to Vince about Edge and Edge making the attack. So Vince says that he'll get Edge at Vengeance.
That doesn't come to fruition. They do not do that match at all.
We'll find out more about that in the coming weeks. John Cena enters. Vince shakes his hand, tells him he's impressed with his debut. But Jericho is so great. Have we ever mentioned that Jericho is like the greatest?
Jericho is probably the most consistent performer of all time.
He looks at John Cena in the same way that you would look at really creepy guy that's just come in and has done something like really awful, and you're just like looking at him with like just disgust and horror. And so Jericho gets in his face and says that because Cena's like the goody two shoes baby faces, so he extends his hand out to Chris Jericho to shake his hand. Jericho gets in his face and says that Cena's disrespectful, which. Again, it's just, he's such a perfect heel because he's the one that's being disrespectful to this guy who's done absolutely nothing to him. Just like, oh, you're disrespectful, you want to shake my hand? Well, that doesn't show me any real respect, does it? And so Cena sends him flying with a massive slap.
Yep.
And Jericho goes absolutely flying over the furniture.
And ruthless aggression, man. He had that shit on lock.
I kind of wonder like how physical that slap actually was.
He probably laid it in.
Yeah. So during the break, Jericho says that he wants to fight Cena tonight and Vince makes the match, and that's what we're going to see a bit later on. So it's like a baptism of fire for Cena, first angle, and now Jericho. Really going in with the top names first.
Yeah, they really must have seen a lot out in him. He was always a built guy. But he's still coming off of his bodybuilder run, and this dude's got veins on top of veins on top of veins. Like, John looks maybe better than he ever did from just a straight-up physical standpoint.
I think now he's back to that sort of level of being very cut and very, like, muscularly defined. He's thinner than he was, but he's got more definition. And then during the main body of his run was the main event, he was just more about size. So we get a Kurt Angle interview, says that he had the flu last week, which is why it took him longer than a couple of minutes to defeat John Cena.
Well, that explains that.
Yeah, again, excellent heel work, but says that he's feeling better and he'll win the Undisputed Championship tonight. Shows a highlight reel with him beating Taker and Hogan. Says that he's an American hero on the 4th of July, so he's going to win it for his country and his people, and walks off. He's very, very, very confident.
He's great.
Hey, Rob, do you like some like very non-subtle humor against homosexuality?
Well, we talked about this is not Stacey Keebler's ass shot. Was not the only ass shot on this show. Because we get a billion check segment, and you're right, Callum. This is very non-subtle, just blatant homophobia. Like, just playing on just really old homosexual stereotypes, and yeah, Billy and Chuck don't age well.
Yeah, so Chuck comes in and he's holding hot dogs because they're supposedly gay, and so they like things that shape like penises. So
it's also the 4th of July.
So they eat the hot dogs, but Rico admonishes them, says that, like, starts waving the wieners in their face. I made myself pop with that online that I wrote in my notes. And says they have to prepare for their title defense tonight, and so eating disgusting things like hot dogs are not going to help them prepare. At least Rico's taking this match seriously like he's building up the threat of Hulk Hogan and Edge.
Well, I think you don't have to build up the threat of Hulk Hogan, because this is probably the biggest thing Chuck ever did in his career.
And speaking of which, it's the World Tag Team Championship match is up next. So Billy and Chuck are defending against Hulk Hogan and Edge. Hogan actually comes out to Real American at this one, so we get to hear the Real American coming out waving the American. It's one of the best theme musics.
I think Real American for Hulk Hogan may be the best theme song ever.
He's waving the American flag. The crowd is going absolutely crazily, as you'd expect. Billy and Chuck then come out. I found it a little bit jarring, and I know this is like just really nitpicking. They're all wearing red.
Yeah.
Yeah, just like, I kind of like a bit of disparity between two teams that are fighting. It's like you would never seen like a football match or a soccer match or anything like that. You wouldn't see the two teams wearing the exact same strip as the other one.
Well, I think that's one of those things that wrestlers should genuinely talk about. Like, as much as they talk about, hey, don't steal my finish, hey, maybe don't wear the same color gear as me.
I think this is the first match of the journey. I could put this note in. I think this is the first match of our entire time watching the SmackDown, the first two episodes, that there was a lock-up to start a match. It's odd, like, how many matches started in this era just with punching, or even with just a throw or a suplex or anything like that, not actually locking up, which is basically the formula that you see in pretty much every match nowadays.
Right. It's one of those things where now we've just completely moved away from a certain style, and instead of having a good mix of styles, it's just all the same thing, just in the opposite direction.
So I won't break this match down in like total detail, but I really, really enjoyed this tag team match.
Yeah.
Up to this point, this was my favorite match in the entire two episodes that we've seen so far. It's Hogan. Hogan's limited, but what Hogan does, it doesn't matter how limited it is, because the crowd is so unbelievably insane for him that everything he does just gets amplified 10 times.
You know, I wonder how Heyman, because we don't hear a lot about Heyman working with Hogan. I wonder how that pairing was, you know?
Well, I don't want to read too much into the fact that Hogan only lasts until August and then he's gone basically for the rest of the until Heyman's pretty much gone. I don't want to read too much into that. I don't think that's Heyman's choice. I think that's more Hogan
not wanting to do a full-time deal.
I think it's more due to the fact that, and I think we'd cover it when he does have that match with Lesnar coming down the line. The idea was that when Lesnar won the championship, then Hogan would be the guy that beat Lesnar for the title.
In the garden, right?
Yeah, because that's what Hogan thought, that he was still the main event top guy. And Vince didn't want to make Hogan the champion again. And so that's kind of led to a bit, not so much a severing between the two of them, but it meant that Hogan was away for probably longer than he originally anticipated.
That sucks. I think I would, and obviously we'll get there, but I think I would have liked Hogan Brock too more than I did Brock Big Show.
Edge is kind of the workhorse in this entire match, because he's doing a lot of the selling to build up to Hogan. They actually build up the hot tag for quite a long time, which is good. We haven't really seen that in a lot of the tag team matches because they've been pretty short. But I thought Chuck and Billy were good in this one as well. Billy, I never really thought too much of Chuck Palumbo, but he was a decent wrestler by this point. Like, some of the underhook, like belly-to-belly throws that he was doing, and the super kick that he hits, it's all pretty neat and tidy.
I thought this match was fun, and it played to the strengths of all four men. Like, Edge gets to be a workhorse, Hogan gets to be a hero, and Billy and Chuck are just good heels that can bump and fly all over the place for Hogan and Edge.
You say four men. I think this played the strength of five men, because at one point Rico trips Edge up on the outside, and so Hogan hits this an atomic drop, which splits him down the guardrail.
Yeah,
that's a spot that should be used more often by somebody. It reminds me of
Hogan loves working with his managers and just making them a part of the match.
Mm. It kind of reminded me of this, the trend that's going around with the Rick Rude selling atomic drops meme.
What a great Twitter account.
Mm. So there's a double big boot spot, and then they hit two leg drops. So Edge hits the first leg drop, and then Hogan hits his leg drop on Chuck.
I'm sorry, I love Edge, but like his leg drop is so tiny compared to the way that Hogan has just perfected that like massive, I'm going to drop the leg on you.
It's kind of like the story of Edge, really, that hitting a move which somebody of his size and build really shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, I guess that's why he also does the spear.
But yeah, so we have Edge gets the pin, and we have new World Tag Team Champions, and yeah, really fun match. It was like the crowd were really into it. It was just, they played to their strengths, as you said. Yeah, it was just a nice title change, our first title change that we see on the entire journey, and yeah, great match.
Fantastic match.
Two thumbs up. Move on to that, to an advertisement for Tori versus Stacy in a bra and panties match later in the show, because nothing says 4th of July like two women stripping each other of their clothing.
Yeah, fireworks, let me tell you.
Let's move on to another match, which, like, if it was to happen nowadays, would be a lot bigger deal.
Would be the main event of WrestleMania.
Yeah, I know, but this is going back to 2002. It's Chris Jericho versus John Cena.
Who is simply wearing the Boston Celtics green and white colors.
Mm. His trunk choices are just so... I mean, I kind of see why he went with such vibrant colors for his t-shirts.
Yeah, it's funny. I always think about... He told this story so much where he asked William Regal for advice, and Regal said, well, if you get a decent pair of trunks and boots, you'll at least look like a wrestler. And John just got every single team sports color he could get to play to the crowd, which is just the worst blue chip babyface thing to do.
So this match is pretty similar in length to the angle one. It's not as well remembered, but it's still, I don't think this is as good a match, because I think Cena looked a little bit less impressive. Maybe he was less adrenaline, because he does this awful power slam again, which I absolutely hate, because it's not even really a power slam, because I see like perfect power slams are like Orton's power slam, Samoa Joe's power slam. That sort of, you get that snap, you get that rotation. He just essentially lifts the guy up and then just plants him down like a world's strongest slam almost.
Yeah.
We basically see every single pinning combination you can do from Cena, small packages, roll ups, everything you could possibly do, because that's what fresh face baby faces do.
Yeah. It's
a very young lion style of way to approach it. You just didn't actually do a Boston Crab, because that is Jericho's move. But that is also one of the big things about Cena, is that Cena at this point in time basically dodges everybody's finisher moves, because Angle didn't hit a single one of his finishers against Cena. Jericho couldn't get the walls in, couldn't hit the Liars and Salt, and Cena was doing everything to him. They were giving Cena a lot, which is,
and it's also a time where it's like, hey, we have to let him dodge these, because should they connect, that's the end of the match.
So Jericho, you know, absolutely. Yeah, just trying to make sure he's protected. But Jericho hits a move which he was trying to get over at the time, called the flashback.
It's the Edge-O-Matic, but you just fall flat.
Yeah, he falls flat onto his front, the guy falls flat onto his back. It's another one of those attempts by Jericho too, because Jericho has always wanted to innovate and always wanted to never stand still. So there was that time in 2001 where he tried using what would eventually become the skull crushing finale.
I think he didn't hit it great, but I like the move.
I like The Miz doing it, but I just think Jericho never hit it properly, because it always seemed a little bit like it took too much to build up. Like, I don't see why you have to lean them back so much and push them so far down. Like, Miz doing it, tripping them up is the way to do it. Yeah, so Jericho hits the flashback, but he then puts his feet on the ropes and everything to get leverage to get the pin, even though Cena didn't exactly struggle to kick out, but it's just, I'm a heel, so I'm going to put my foot on the ropes and win the match. Post-match, Jericho alludes that he's going to give Cena a handshake, but takes another cheap shot. Cena then takes him out with a spinning side slam. He does that. That's the one move we've seen that he still does.
Yeah, the protoplex.
Yeah, so... And so Jericho heads off running. So Cena looks still a bit strong, even though he's 0-2 now.
I like that he went for multiple stinger splash attempts in this match. I don't know when he stopped doing it, but I'm grateful that he did.
So we get a Rey Mysterio hype package. Also throughout the show, peppered in, they're doing a number of like the people's moments. So they're just hyping up The Rock's return by showing some of his best bits on SmackDown, and yeah, to make sure that everyone gets excited for his return, even though he's already back and he's already appeared on Raw a couple of times. They do a recap of Divas Undressed, so they don't show much of the actual show itself, but they show Tori winning and Stacy saying they only happened because she's sleeping with Maven, who is one of the judges for the show. Then Tori talks about how Stacy sleeps with Vince, because that's the sort of level we're at. So you're just accusing people of sleeping with other people.
On the day that we're recording this, when like multiple things are coming out about the wrestling industry, and Tori's just walking out with like a Golden Thong Award and first ever WWE Undressed Champion sign flashes in the crowd. It is such a night and day from then and now, and I cannot be happier about that.
But before we get to that match, we want to talk about one of the other highlights of the show, in my opinion, which was the video package where Jamie Noble and Nydia arrived at their, like, he's bought a pickup truck and a double wide trailer for himself and Nydia. I absolutely adore the Jamie Noble character and the Nydia character. Obviously, they're a brilliant package. I love the fact that he's won a championship, and that means that he's earning more money and he's living the high life. We don't see enough of that.
We don't. I love everything about this. This is a very underrated pairing. Just great. Like you said, he's won a championship, so that means he's winning more money. And that's something that, if you were to do that nowadays, it'd be, haha, look at this inside wink nudge. You know, we all know that they're earning the same pay regardless. I miss the naivety that comes along with just believing, oh, he won the belt, so that's more money.
Well, yeah, just consider that's about the 24/7 championship. I mean, they've already said in canon with our truth that he doesn't know why he wants to be the 24/7 champion. It just has a hold on him. It's like saying, okay, so there's no benefit to being 24/7 champion. People just like having shiny gold things.
Whereas
Jamie Noble has a championship, and now he's living a life of luxury, and he talks about the fact that he never wants to go hungry again. They've got, to be fair, it shows how poor he was beforehand, because they talk about how he's got running water now, and that's a luxury for them. And then they go into the bedroom, and it's like a full-size double bed, and so Nydia wants to break it in immediately. So again, it's down that route again, but at least they're together, and it makes sense for their characters.
Yeah, and Nydia sells the water really good too. So Nydia, good for her. She really grabbed on to wrestling a lot better than Maven did, I think.
Yeah, just a shame that after this character, they just had no idea what to do with her.
They had nothing else for her.
So we move on to what the Divas era was designed for at this point in time, which is skin. And so we have Tori Wilson versus Stacey Keibler in a bra and panties match. Tori's, like you said, holding the Golden Thong trophy. Stacey immediately hits a slap, because that was one of the signature moves that every woman had in both in real life and in the video games. Basically, I'm thinking Tori's finisher in some of the video games was just a slap to the face.
Well, to be fair, it was literally called Woman's Slap, and all the Divas had them, because 2002.
There's a move in this match that I haven't seen too often, which was a drop toe hold by Stacey, which essentially guillotines Tori on the bottom rope. Again, it's just one of those simple things that you just go, why don't people do that nowadays?
I think because it became, well, if you're going to do anything like that, it has to be to Ray, so Ray can drop to hold you into the ropes to the 619 kind of thing.
So Tori catapults Stacey into the corner, and then she uses that to take Stacey's top off eventually. They do a roll over the referee catfight spot that you saw in every single one of these matches in this era.
They would eventually get to the point where, you know, they would roll over the referee, and the referee would be like, yeah, they touched me. I think we're about a year out from that. But yeah, stuff like that happened where it was just full on over sexuality.
Stacey does a roundhouse kick, but loses her balance on her standing foot, and so she basically falls leg first onto Tori Wilson's face.
Tori has legs?
Stacey has legs, I think you found.
Tori
does have legs.
But Stacey has legs, according to Kid Rock.
Yeah, but based on this kick, I don't know if she quite knows how to use them quite as well as the song seems to. Privesh, she does. Tori does some sort of Icona roll and uses that to pull the shorts down. So Stacy strips the bra and panties without Tori losing an item of clothing. I think that if this is the sort of match you're going to do, there was way too much wrestling in it.
I think they wanted to, like, hey, we're not just Barbie dolls, but, like, they were literally being paid at the time to be Barbie dolls.
I get that argument, but it's just a case of the crowd knows what you're doing this match for. You know what you're doing this match for. So why do you have it go 6-7? Like, this match goes longer than some of the other matches on this actual show.
Probably. Dude, I'm very glad that Charlotte Flair exists. That's all I can think about when I watch stuff like this, where it's just like, wow. Their whole idea of getting each other into pinning predicaments was to get that person's clothes off so you could smack their ass. You know, like, it's just weird.
So Tori celebrates by removing all of her clothing and just wearing her patriotic blue and white bra and panties.
Wasn't the whole goal not to lose your clothing, and then she just lost it anyway?
You are right, but I kind of always go with that argument that it's just the goal of the match is to make sure that you don't get stripped of your bra and panties. It's not because you don't want to show your bra and panties, it's just that if you do, it means you lose the match. So Tori's like, she's totally fine just stripping down at any point, any opportunity, but she won't do it if she has to lose the match. She'll wait until after she's won the match, and then she'll do it.
And I do want to comment on what you say every time we talk about this. Don't know why this is taboo, and it's like, that's typical wrestling gear anyway, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's just, yeah, I mean, I saw, she puts that, putting that clothing on, it's not even that much more than what she was wearing in the match in the first place.
Yeah,
it's not really much
really.
More than what you see, like, I don't know, an Alexa Bliss or a Peyton Royce wearing nowadays.
It's just a weird thing.
So we move on to a recap of the Jeff Hardy Undertaker match. I would urge anyone who hasn't seen that match to check it out.
You really should.
July 1st, 2002 episode of Raw. It's one of Jeff Hardy. I don't say it's one of his best matches, but it's a match that kind of showed that he could be a main eventer one day. Then we have an Undertaker interview, talks about how he's upset that even though he's been granted a match with The Rock at Vengeance, Vince clarified to Taker that that match would happen whether he was champion or not. And so he feels disrespected about the fact that Vince doesn't believe that he'll be champion coming out of this. I hate Undertaker's promos at this point in time. They're too long-winded. They go on too long. He meanders around points all the time. He says that he's a citizen of America, albeit not a model one, and then talks about how he'd be a better ally in a war situation than Kurt Angle would be.
Well,
I don't see the point in it.
There's no point in it, but I just feel like America, war, hey, I'm the big dog, almost, like, you know?
Yeah, that's probably about it, really. So the interview gets cut off really abruptly because they do an advertisement for a Triple H DVD they were putting out. It's like, it gets cut out before I think Undertaker even finishes a sentence, and it's just like, oh, Triple H has got a new DVD out. Way to undercut your Undisputed Champion there.
Yeah, but you're undercutting the Undisputed Champion for Triple H. Yeah. Triple H always wins, guys.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to the main event of the show, WWE Undisputed Championship match. The Undertaker defending the championship against Kurt Angle. If you've never seen Undertaker versus Kurt Angle matches, they're some of the best matches of Undertaker's career.
Mm-hmm.
Undertaker at this point in time wasn't really... He was moving towards that direction, but he was never really known as being a standout bell-to-bell guy, whereas that's basically Kurt Angle's entire mantra is he's built around the fact that he has the best matches on any show that he's on, and this was no exception. This was probably the best match of the night and an excellent World Championship match.
Excellent World Championship match. A match I vividly recall watching because of the finish, actually, where Taker goes for last ride, Angle gets him in a triangle choke, and for the first time in my life, and maybe for the first time and only time many years down the road, Taker taps out to the Kurt Angle triangle. And that at that point, that was the most human I'd ever seen The Undertaker.
Yeah, so this is the big controversial finish to this one, is the fact that it ends in a tie, due to the fact that Angle put him in the triangle choke, Undertaker taps out at the same time that Angle is getting pinned. So even though a couple of the referees come out, there's this big, it actually goes to a break on the actual TV. If you're watching it on TV, it would go to a break. and then they'd come back and they were still fighting over which one of them is the champion. One of them raises Angle's hand, so Angle thinks that he's won, then the other one raises Undertaker's hand. They do the whole shebang like they usually do. And Coda announces just officially that it's a draw, so Undertaker retains the title on a draw. But they are building up this whole storyline, the fact that Angle is making people tap out that wouldn't usually tap out. So he's already made Hogan tap out at King of the Ring. Now he's made The Undertaker tap out. But yeah, the match itself was... I mean, it's not the best match they end up having, because if you want to see that, then definitely No Way Out 2006. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is that's the best match of these two's career, was at least against each other. But this match was still really good. There was like... Taker at one point goes for a tombstone, which is something that he wasn't really doing so much in his badass character.
That's just a ploy for Kurt Angle to grab the leg.
Angle has Taker in the ankle lock for like quite a while. And so there's this excellent spot where Undertaker goes for a chokeslam and he hit the chokeslam, but he loses his footing while doing the chokeslam because his ankle hurts so much. It's just such brilliant selling. Just
yeah,
that sort of thing, that the little details that you only see a certain like percentage of wrestlers do nowadays.
I agree with that 100%. And I really do miss this style of wrestling. And it's funny, as much as we want to like laugh at Edge and Randy Orton, they recently had a match. And Undertaker actually did a podcast interview where he said that match restored his faith in wrestling, because that match is more akin to what he feels wrestling should be. And when you look at a match like this, it's easier to understand.
Yeah, that's quite interesting that he says that, because the next time Undertaker gets in the ring, I'll probably lose my faith in wrestling.
You know, there is a strong possibility of that.
So Undertaker retained, he celebrates with the title, so Angle assaults him from behind and puts on the ankle lock again. I think it's funny that Undertaker doesn't tap in this ankle lock, even though the match is over. But so the referees have to pull Angle off of Undertaker because he's putting so much pressure onto it. And so Angle leaves, like, the one that's standing tall at the end of it, like, just talking about the fact that he made Undertaker tap, and that's the end of the show. So they're obviously building up to the idea that even though Undertaker has beef with The Rock, and that's going to be something that he's dealing with in the coming future, Angle now has a legitimate claim to be the WWE champion, the Undisputed Champion. And so that would build up into a three-way feud heading towards Vengeance.
And you do end up getting one of the better triple threats of that era, if not all time. And I can't wait till we get to cover that in the Patreon exclusive.
Absolutely. So overall, this is a big thumbs up show for me.
Yeah. So and I don't know. Like, I don't know if it's just because I'm comparing and nostalgic, but like, wow, this takes me back to such a time where it's like, geez, this was the TV show. Imagine what the pay-per-views are like. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
What great stuff this all is.
I love the fact that how much effort they put into a show, which they must have known would absolutely tank in the ratings.
Yeah.
Like this had some fall in it. It had championship matches. It had a title change. It had things that were like really, I mean, you say what you will about the Tori Stacy thing. It was a slap in the face of women's empowerment, and it's glad that those things no longer happen. But that was the thing that a lot of people wanted to see at this point in time. And so they gave all of that stuff into this show. I don't say like it's not like a mini pay-per-view, but it was like a bumper edition of SmackDown for a show that absolutely got no attention, at least live.
Yeah.
So hopefully people did at least watch it in the replay and got to see some of the fun stuff, because, yeah, this was a really fun episode.
And this is also knee-deep in the spoiler era, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because they were obviously filming in advance. But I don't know how big the spoilers were, like, because the internet was a big deal in 2002, but it wasn't as big as it is nowadays. There's no social media at this point in time, or no prominent social media, should I say.
This is probably in the era where you can comfortably say, nobody's reading that except for the smarks who are going to watch anyway.
Yeah, this is the point in time where people would still get physical copies of the newsletter, the like Observer newsletter, rather than get the digital ones.
Can you imagine? You know, just real quick, can you imagine having to wait in the mail for the physical newsletter? Like, as soon as the Observer drops, it's like, okay, there's your news. You got to go and see what's out there. I can't imagine how that was, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah, it's not something, not an era that you want to live in now, in this like on-demand era that we're currently living in.
Yeah,
essentially,
really.
If you want something, you can just find it pretty quickly and get it pretty quickly. But yeah, but there was like just a lot of good stuff in this. So you get sick to see Cena, Batista, and Orton in their like their really early formative years, and Cena getting this continued push against Jericho, even though he lost. But you get to see a match that would be legendary nowadays, but back then was just a young rookie against a veteran. You have like a world championship match, which is really good. You get to see a title change in the tag team title match. You get to see the formation of a strong heel trio. And they got a lot of heat to kick off with. And yeah, it was just, it's just a really well put together 2 hours of wrestling.
And I couldn't be more happy to go back in time and watch it.
Yeah, I don't know if the next week's one will have the same kind of flow to it, because what we'll see next week is pretty much the fallout from this one. I believe the main event of next week's one, if I just check my notes, is we get to see the continuation of John Cena's build as he's in the main event, teaming with The Undertaker to take on Kurt Angle and Chris Jericho.
Let's say that. Say that one again through 2020 eyes. Undertaker tags with John Cena to take on Kurt Angle and Chris Jericho. That is a full-blown sellout, a full-blown, you know, buy rate increase, network subscription increase, any day of the week right now.
Yeah, so that's like, that's a huge match that we get to, well, we'll get to enjoy, and we'll be reviewing on the next edition, episode 3. There's also the episode where The Rock makes his return, so get to see that as well. Get to see another World Tag Team Championship match. So we get to see a women's championship match. We actually get to see women's wrestling on an episode of SmackDown.
Hell yeah.
We get to find out who Randy Orton's next tag team partner is to try and beat D-Von and Batista. Yeah, there's a lot to look forward to. So
lots of just awesome stuff. And the best thing about this is you can look at it now and you can see John Cena on the rise. You can see Taker at a time where he was more full-time. Hogan at a bizarre time where he was still kind of full-time, even though it's all these years later. Just really fun stuff.
And of course, the highlight of the entire episode next week is the week. It's the week that Kevin Nash tears his quad, guys. Yeah.
And that will signal the end for the New World Order's god-awful run in the WWE, which we did not cover on this podcast. But if you want us to cover it on this podcast, you should check out Smart Out Moments Patreon. And if you donate to the Pick Your Poison tier, you can tell us, hey, I want you to cover the entire NWO run in WWE. And we'll say, you know what? Because you donated, we will gladly do that.
Yeah, absolutely. We'd definitely do a review of that. But even if you could only spare a dollar, that's all, you know, it's all greatly appreciated. Just goes up a little way to keeping the lights on, mean we can produce more of this content for you guys. And yeah, there's other ways you can support us. If you want to support us another way financially, but and get something out of it in return, but something tangible that you can hold in your own hands, then you can go to the TeePublic or Redbubble shops, get a t-shirt, get a shower curtain, get a towel, get... I'm not entirely sure what everything you can sell on there, but whatever they can offer, you probably can find something with some sort of Smart Cow Moment branding.
That's right.
So,
and you can do that for our blue brand, which is Fanboys Anonymous. So same thing over there, patreon.com/fanboysanonymous, Redbubble, TeePublic, Fanboys Anonymous. So do all that stuff that greatly supports Tony and by proxy supports us. You know, next time we come to you, it will be with something great from the three of us, I'm sure. And it'll be a lot of fun. But Callum's got some other plugs. Callum, what else are you going to plug?
So just a few more things. We try and like wrap these up in the end, whereas Tony tries to subtly put
sprinkle them into the
middle. Yeah, we're kind of just all at the end type of approach here on our podcast. But so you want to... If you want to sign up to keep up the conversation with us, you can sign up for the Megamaniacs, like Smart Out Moment on Facebook, on Twitter, all the other social media platforms. Vote in the Sexy Superstar Tournament, which is going on right now. I believe it's still going on at this point, but yeah. So
it should very much be going on at this point.
Keep going. It's the hottest tournament of the summer. Check out all the other articles on smilecamoment.com, including the ones that we contribute to. Just keep watching and listening to all the other great stuff we've got going on. You can follow me on Twitter at Weekmeister14. Rob, do you want to throw out your individual
and
stuff?
And I'll just wrap it up by saying you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Dude Felice. Check out WrestleZone. Check out Fightful. They're keeping you up to date with all the scoops that are bringing the real fireworks on this 4th of July. So check that stuff out, and we'll catch you guys down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. So happy 4th of July to everyone listening to this. Hope you're having a great day. Hope you get to enjoy some fireworks, but maybe stay indoors while you do it. Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows where we're going to be at the 4th of July this year, but thank you very much for listening. We'll see you for episode 3. But for now, this has been another Smile Count moment, and we are being counted out.